Good afternoon. I'm Rhonda Feynman, and this is the Healthy Options program right here on WERU Community Radio. Today, we welcome back geriatric psychiatrist Dr. Susan Weary. We've invited her back to explore what new information and to reinforce information that we've talked about before about staying healthy and resilient as we age, at any age. So this is for everybody because, you know, we are all aging. Dr. Susan Weary has been a passionate advocate for older people throughout her career. That's 40 plus years, during which she has held a variety of clinical, administrative, academic, and consulting roles across the country. Dr. Weary has served as Chief of Geriatrics at the University of New England College of Osteopathic Medicine, and for several years had been the Commissioner of Vermont's Department of Disabilities, Aging, and Independent Living. During her tenure as commissioner, Vermont rose to number one for senior health in America's health rankings. She was also honored to represent Vermont at the White House Conference on Aging in 2015. As a clinician, educator, policymaker, advocate, and advisor, Dr. Weary has shared her work with students, professionals, older adults, and family caregivers throughout the United States and abroad. Thank you so much, Dr. Weary, for returning to Healthy Options.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
So tell us a little bit about the work that you're doing now. What are you up to?
Yeah, so there are two things that really occupy most of my time and a great deal of my energy. One is overseeing a project called the Micro-Credentialing Project for the Geriatrics Workforce Enhancement Program, which is a HRSA federally funded program trying to create a more age-capable and dementia-friendly workforce. That's it in a nutshell. We had an opportunity to try something that we think is truly innovative, which is to create micro-credentialing and career ladders for direct care workers, specifically certified nursing assistants in working in long-term care, because that was the Fed's big interest. And so we have been doing that for the last year and a half, and we will be enrolling our first cohort of certified nursing assistants, CNAs, in a couple of weeks to give them the opportunity to really acquire and hone their dementia care skills, and then also to demonstrate their competency. So the wish here is that having really acquired and honed these competent knowledge, skills, attitudes in long-term care, they will be able once and for all to receive a livable wage, and as well as to provide good care. So this is all part of the effort to recognize that these are professionals, and to give them both the credit, the recognition, and ultimately the wages that they're due. So I'm very excited about it.
This is so interesting. So these are people doing direct care. Is this in nursing facilities or a senior center? Who are these people?
Because this is grant funded and the feds have a goal of trying to up the care, if you will, in nursing homes. So as a very specific deliverable, we are beginning as a pilot this micro-credentialing project specifically in nursing homes. It is so applicable, though, across the continuum. I'm quite confident that direct care workers, whether they are working as home health aides, in the home, in nursing homes, in hospitals, will be interested in and looking at these badges, which are being offered actually through Southern Maine Community College. So we're going to really maximize the access to it.
So this is teaching these individuals more about what's the curriculum? What's special about this?
Yeah. So I think there are two things I think that are really special about it. One is not to get too far in the weeds, but perhaps getting in the weeds is appropriate because this is a granular process, right? So we actually had this very cool process of bringing together a lot of people from the industry people in senior centers, people in long-term care, families, people living with dementia, random older adults. And we basically said to them, if I told you that somebody had a geriatrics specialist badge, what would you expect them to know? What would you expect them to be able to do? What would you expect them? How would you expect them to go about their work? And this is what's sort of building the competencies. So we ended up with three, what we call stackable badges. So people are going to learn person-centered dementia care. So they learn about dementia. They learn about its progression. They learn about preserved strengths. They learn about how to individualize care. And then in addition, they will learn about this framework called age-friendly. And a key component, they will learn about self-care and how to create the conditions in which self-care can occur. So there's sort of like these three micro-credentials add up to one geriatric specialist. So go ahead. Not sure if that's exactly what you're asking, but.
Yeah, no, this is I think this really dovetails very, very directly into the idea of what's healthy aging, what does our brain do, and what is dementia? How do we even know if we have it? And then when we need care, it seems like this level, the CNA, are the people that you're going to see mostly. And so in a lot of situations, so that's really important to really have all of this as a package. So let's kind of break that apart a little bit and really come right into, so what is healthy aging and what does all of this mean?
It is, one thing I want people to understand is that we actually, culturally, society, public health, have had a real impact on the incidence of dementia. Because we have an increasing older adult population, what you mostly hear about is the prevalence. That is to say, how many people have dementia, all caused due to Alzheimer's disease or vascular dementia, as it's sometimes called, or multi-infarct, or Lewy body, or frontotemporal, all these causes of dementia. But if you look over the last 20, 30 years, the incidence, that is to say, age-specific new cases are actually going down. And we credit this to lifestyle choices and to greater attention to cardiovascular health, actually. So it's kind of like what's good for the heart is good for the brain. So what is healthy aging? What is healthy brain aging? I guess one definition of healthy aging, is the capacity and the reserve to thrive in the way one wishes. Now, a healthy brain is one in which you sort of follow the lifestyle recommendations for what really works to do. There are two things really that you're doing, right? When you're trying to promote health, you're avoiding things that are bad for you, so to speak, and you're increasing things that are good for you. So we call that, decreasing risk factors or increasing protective factors. And we have learned, we're learning so much about the brain and about ways to keep it healthy as though it's separate, right?
Yeah,
it's like, well, the brain is sitting over here and here's how we water it, right? So it's kind of hard. You got to kind of think of this more in a more integrated fashion. But to isolate it for a moment, we know, for example, and the most recent study is called the U.S. Pointer Study. We know, for example, that physical exercise is the foundation of all healthy brain aging, and frankly, healthy aging as well. But it's only recently that we've been able to kind of fine-tune that recommendation to say, well, everybody knows exercise is good for you, but how much you need and of what kind to actually reduce the risk? And I'm going to say it that way for starters and then say that that's actually not the same as promoting a healthy brain. but it is about reducing the risk. So they're both there. So reducing the risk, we now know the dose and the frequency.
Oh, my goodness.
150 minutes a week of aerobic activity. That's 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week. Seems to be like the magic threshold number for reducing risk. Again, what I would like listeners to understand is that this is a population health level, right? So you do this with, you know, 5,000 people, and that has predictive power, if you will, for reducing risk. That may or may not be true for a given individual. A given individual may get by with, I don't know, 15 minutes a day. But what nobody gets by with is not moving at all. And the reason is that people really need to maintain good circulation, getting oxygen and glucose to the brain. And we do know that for all individuals, that physical exercise with some specific kinds of physical exercise will actually lead to the creation of new brain cells, this thing that we call neuroplasticity. So you can get some new brain cells, you can get some new connections. And in the physical activity or physical exercise realm, the data now on yoga and Tai Chi is really compelling. And I think that that is possibly primarily because, let's take Tai Chi, for example. It is a whole mind-body enterprise, right? There are steps to learn, there are movements to learn, there are motions to learn, there are sequences. So it really engages all parts of the brain, which have different functions. Tai Chi is also often done in a group, and there is the added benefit there of the social connection. And then it is movement. And we know that, we know so much about Tai Chi now. We know that it improves balance. We know that it improves strength. We know that it reduces the risk of developing dementia. And we also know, and this is on the health promotion side, that it enhances an overall sense of well-being. And as people have greater comfort in their mind body, they are more likely to do things. So I'm aware, Rhonda, as I'm circling very excited.
No, I want to hear more. This is fabulous. And I want to follow up. We actually have done programs and practiced Tai Chi, and we can talk about that more in a second. If you have just tuned in, I'm Rhonda Feynman. This is the Healthy Options Program on WERU Community Radio. We're speaking with Dr. Susan Weary about aging well and how we can all be resilient and help others stay resilient as we age. And we are learning about the ancient practice of Tai Chi, which has become quite relevant. Now, you know, part of Tai Chi practice is actually a martial art, but and one can take it to these different ideas of push hands and softening. Strength through softening is one of the principles. The 10 principles of Tai Chi. So let's think about that in the world, and also our the greater world. But you were going to say something. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it sounds like you're a practitioner.
I am. I am.
And see, Rhonda, here's what's very interesting to me about Tai Chi. I am not, but I intend to to engage in Tai Chi quite seriously because I have recently identified a Tai Chi studio that actually honors coming out of that martial arts background, but with this kind of awareness and the softening, as you say. And I will say this, that why that has held some greater appeal for me is that it is a strength-based, strength-honoring, more culturally grounded studio. Tai Chi is offered a lot of places. But here's the interesting thing to me about the way we often approach healthy aging. Aging is often approached as some period of life in which decline is inevitable, and healthy aging means prevent that at all costs. Healthy aging means you're going to have poor balance, so work on improving your balance. But even people who talk about strength, they start with an assumption of deficit, that here's what you're going to be at risk for, and so you better get busy and start exercising. As opposed to, you know, exercise feels pretty good. Having an active mind body feels pretty good. Doing Tai Chi feels pretty good. And so you don't have to adopt this, I'm going to my Tai Chi class because my daughter's afraid I'm going to fall. It's a matter of balance. You know what I mean? Our whole frame.
Absolutely. We look at things as a pathology instead of as a strength. Because we are aging. Everybody's aging, you know.
Yes.
Isn't there a joke about it? What goes up and never comes down? Okay, right. Other than a staircase. But it's also... because the staircase goes up and down. Oh, you see, I told the joke wrong. All right. What does that mean? All right. Okay. Uh-oh. Is that a sign of something? Okay. Right. We'll talk about that too. The assumption that anytime you forget something or do it wrong, that it means, oh no, that's like a red flag. All right. But I do want to just get that sense of that this is what we're doing. We're living and we are, it is a natural part of our lives. And this is stuff to enhance our lives as life happens.
That's exactly right. So we're building cognitive reserves. We're nurturing our resilience. We're enjoying the process of doing it. We're not, like, not everything is like in this, as you said, we don't have to pathologize and then prevent pathology. So that even though I do want people to be aware, reducing risk is a valuable thing and it's having real impact at the population health level. The real reason to engage in what we know reduces risk is because in the process of engaging and doing it, you will feel better. And at the same time, building resilience and building some cognitive reserve. So one of the other things I really want to make sure that we cover is stress reduction and what we are increasingly appreciative of in terms of the impact of the last decade on all our brains. But I'm aware, Rhonda, before I go there, that I didn't address one of your questions, which is, what is dementia? I keep using the term, and I do want to go to the side what I should have said at the beginning, which is...
It's fine.
Okay, thank you. When we use the term dementia, it's really an umbrella term that describes a decline in cognitive function across all brain function. So it could be memory, it could be orientation, it could be problem solving, it could be around abstract reasoning, it could be around processing, any kind of judgment decision, language function, not being able to find the word you want or not understanding what other people's words are and so forth. So we have kind of, I think, overprivileged memory as a cognitive function. And so when memory is a little less efficient, I think it is the memory function that causes people such angst, frankly, somewhat unnecessarily. So just as you did a moment ago, oh, is that a sign? What happens for most people, and of course, dementia has a lot of different causes. The most common cause being Alzheimer's disease. And so it's the one that people worry about the most. But dementia, again, is a sort of broad term of cognitive decline, is a level of decline that interferes with function. It's different. And it is pathological. It's not something that awaits us all. There are very specific disorders that cause dementia. And people who have mild cognitive impairment, which is another popular term, are people who are experiencing a degree of cognitive change that is probably greater than their age peers, but not sufficient to interfere with function. Interestingly, mild cognitive impairment, in my experience clinically and just with my friends, seems to have more impact on self-image and self-esteem and on the development of dementia worry than actual impairment. So I think the latest data shows that for some people, mild cognitive impairment does herald the probable onset of dementia due to Alzheimer's disease, for some. Some people with mild cognitive impairment will never get worse, particularly if they adopt some of these lifestyle practices that we're talking about. So they'll never get worse. And then there's another group, maybe as much as a third, maybe only a quarter, who will actually get better, because mild cognitive impairment rears its ugly head. And I say it like that because it really does scare people.
Yes.
Following periods of profound stress. And so coming out of COVID, and the stress of that, again, collectively and individually, was really quite profound. And we know that when people are under stress, they produce a lot of cortisol. And cortisol is a stress hormone. It gets us ready for fight or flight. It's an evolutionary benefit. But when you are under the kind of chronic stress that we have experienced as a culture, really, take your favorite turning point. But, you know, I'm going to just say COVID for today. There has been this steady drip, 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 drip of cortisol. And we know from brain imaging that two constant high levels of cortisol actually shrink a part of the brain that we need for short-term memory. That part of the brain is called the hippocampus. I'm sure a lot of listeners are very familiar with the hippocampus because people talk about it all the time. It is the first brain structure in dementia due to Alzheimer's disease that really shows up prominently, which is why you see pretty common in certain kinds of Alzheimer's, which is why you see people not remembering what they had for breakfast, not remembering a new people that they have just met, but remembering pretty effortlessly things from long ago. And so a lot of work now, I think, in terms of promoting healthy brain aging is looking for those strategies that are known to reduce cortisol. I'll see if that's where you'd like to go.
Well, definitely. There are two things. Yes, I definitely want to discuss that because when I told a number of people that I was doing this program, a number said, well, my husband's just been diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment. Does that mean he's going to get dementia? And how will we know? So that was one of the major questions. And I won't, so perhaps we can talk about that a little bit. And I also want to go back to yoga as part of the healthy, resilient practices that we can do. But let's continue on with that sense of fear. And she was describing a lot of depression, a lot of worry, a lot of great concern about this.
Yeah. So thank you for underscoring that because I want the message to be really clear. Mild cognitive impairment does not mean you're going to get dementia due to any cause. It could mean that you are at higher risk. And there are definitely things that you can do to improve cognitive functioning, whether you've been diagnosed with MCI or whether you just suspect it. And the the message here, and I'm so glad you decided to do this program. The message here is that the staying stuck in fear actually maintains this stress level and this higher cortisol level. So it really does negatively impact your brain to stay stuck there. It is totally understandable that when people, you know, get a name to what they've been wondering about with their cognitive changes, like mild cognitive impairment, it sounds scary. Some advertisers will tell you that you need to do something about it, like take a medication to prevent Alzheimer's disease. But that really doesn't address the facts. And the facts as best we know them. Again, some people will get better, will improve from their mild cognitive impairment. Some people will stay the same. And for some people, it will in fact be an early sign and their cognition will get worse. So I think in addressing that fear and not letting it go into a kind of pervasive anxiety or to lead to depression, it's really important that that people who have MCI decide how they're going to take charge of their brain health, right? And what, if any, lifestyle changes they want to make, if they need to, or the other way I like to say it is, what is giving you joy and not fear? Do more of that. So it's not like you have to change your whole lifestyle. It's that you have to be strategic and to look at the data and say, okay, what do we know? Like, what helps? Well, I've mentioned Tai Chi. You've asked me to make sure we get back to yoga. And the data on yoga is not unlike that on Tai Chi. When things like Tai Chi and yoga intentionally honor the fact that the mind and body are connected, so you are within your body as much as within your mind, and you're moving, right? And movement, we are designed to move. We need to move.
We've evolved. We've evolved to move.
We've evolved to move. Exactly. Exactly. So we, I think that the reason that yoga gets kind of called out and studied is because, in addition to this health, having this health promoting function, it has been known for a long time to assist with some discomforts of later life, like arthritis, and again, like fear of falling. So people who are engaged in yoga do have better balance. They do have a reduction in pain, particularly arthritic kinds of pain, musculoskeletal kinds of pain. And so given that, if you have been an active person, you're actually more likely to have some wearing out joints. It's nice to have some tools, like in yoga, for being able to isolate that, work with it, and to begin to have a little bit more fluidity in movement. Because, again, I think a problem for a lot of older adults who are kind of surprised, they've been healthy and active, kind of surprised, oh my gosh, I'm also getting a little stiffer, you know, and you think, oh, I didn't think that was going to happen to me. And so there is, for people who have fallen, an increased fear, and they begin to trust their bodies less. So things that help you trust your body more are things like yoga and exercise programs that enhance your strength. And interestingly, with increased strength and increased confidence in your body, people actually experience less depression and kind of a greater overall sense of well-being. So I think what I say to people who have mild cognitive impairment, let's work to keep you in one of those groups where it doesn't get worse and it might get better. But let's do it in a way that says, what is unique for you? Your diet's already pretty good. Let's not get all preoccupied with this rigid following of a Mediterranean diet. If you have a reasonably healthy diet, good for you. If you are a physically active person already and you're getting those 150 minutes a week or whatever the data says, it doesn't mean you have to do that more aggressively. So everybody has to start like with a personal inventory and say, wow, we've got these areas that we know are good for your brain. So let me list some more of them. I've talked about some of the physical movements. One I've talked about, mentioned at least diet.
If you give a hold that thought, because we have to do a little business. If people have just tuned in and cannot turn away from this program, I want you to know that this is the Healthy Options Program on WERU Community Radio. I'm Rhonda Fineman. We're speaking about the aging brain, about how to stay resilient and happy and joyful. How about that? With geriatric psychiatrist Dr. Susan Weary. So, yes, I just want to say about yoga, you know, when you're doing standing poses and you're really allowing the vessels and the bones to actually get strengthened, it's another powerful thing. And all the other aspect is, if you are worried that you are too stiff to do it, there are ways to, quote, lift the floor. There are props. You can use a chair. You can, use a wall. As we said in the years of teaching yoga, there is nothing magical about the floor. If you cannot do a standing pose and touch the floor, you're not missing anything. There's nothing down there that you're not seeing if you're balanced on a chair or some other object. So just wanted to put that in as we progress. You want to, let's talk about diet and magnesium.
Okay, let's talk about diet. But I'm going to first thank you for reminding me that there's nothing magic about the floor. we're so competitive.
Aggressive.
I acknowledge that personally, and I think it's probably true for a lot of people listening. You know, it's like, I'm not using a block, as though it's not, you know, that's not good yoga, or that's not real yoga, or... I remember the first time I was offered some kind of rolled blanket or a bolster to assist with a position. I felt so defeated, right? The exact opposite, you know, and I know that that's just this competitive thing, right? But what a great opportunity to learn. Okay, nothing wrong with competition, but let go of it if it's in your way. And so to hear you remind me that there's nothing magic about the floor was a gift. Thank you.
Yeah, oh, good. Yeah. Yes. And yes, no straining required.
No straining, no judgment, no like, oh, the, everything is so driven around self-improvement and, you know, avoiding this, which is why I hope what is coming across is my personal pivot and to this recognition that the efforts at enhancing health need themselves to be joyful and need themselves to be smart. Not smart goals help you stay on track, but really what's important is that people enjoy what they're doing and that they know what will benefit them and what they don't have to bother doing, particularly if it doesn't bring them any joy. So I've talked about diet. I'm not a nutritionist and I'm not really an expert in this area. So I think if for listeners who are really interested in learning more about the Mediterranean diet, I recommend doing it, or any other diet, sort of vegetarian diets, plant-based diets, you know, whole grains, that sort of thing. I've had to kind of modify my recommendations around alcohol. The National Council on Aging has always said, the data around alcohol has been this, that for adult women over the age of 40, that one drink a day was considered safe. And so up to five drinks a week, I think, was the actual data, right? And for men, it was two drinks a day or up to 10 drinks a week. And it has to do with, you know, the way our bodies are different, the way we metabolize, but also the relative amount of fat and leanness that we have. So that was always the recommendation. And so safe meant that it wasn't associated with any increased risk for cardiovascular disease or for dementia. But it's pretty clear now that alcohol does no favors for the brain. You know, despite what you read sometimes about red wine being good for you, it is probably a good idea for most people who are worried to reduce their alcohol intake, even if you're only at the one a day. And the one a day is, you know, there are even definitions around this. That's one beer, 1 5-ounce glass of wine, or one shot of whiskey if you're a spirits girl. So it's, you know, it's like being smart about it rather than worrying about everything that we do, because worry makes it worse. And so I'm kind of on this mission to reduce worry by, you know, making sure that people feel empowered to take control of their brain health and have fun or joy doing it.
So we talk about, you know, the can we have fun without alcohol? That is, you know, is it possible? You know, I hate to say it, is a little bit of a solvent? Is it destroying brain cells? So we do that on one hand, and then we go do, you know, standing poses and Tai Chi to help build the brain cells. It's so complicated.
Yeah. True enough. You know, it's funny because most assisted livings, which is where people will often go if they're beginning to feel like they can't quite manage on their own, are notorious for alcohol-infused social hours. And it's exactly as you say, you know, it, for many people, it is a solvent, it kind of mutes the frontal lobes a little bit, takes away self-judgment, makes some people more loquacious. And social connection is really good for you. So that's what I mean about that personal inventory. I don't want anybody to go around saying, okay, I can't drink, can't smoke, I have to do 150 minutes of exercise a week, I have to be connected to other people, find purpose and meaning in my life. And, you know, it's like making the matter worse by wanting to tick the boxes. So,
Troy, I want to talk about, you know, we talked about mild cognitive impairment and how would we know if something is getting worse. But what is our memory as we get older? Is forgetting a name something, then we have to go, oh, my goodness, I have X, Y, and Z now? I mean, what's a parameter? How do we know if we have something? Other than, you know, what we see on TV, if we should take every X, Y, and Z supplement, which we're not going to go into right now. But
right, exactly, yeah. Exactly. You know, in our desire to categorize things, there is a category, there's a bucket of descriptors for age-associated memory changes. And they're real. They vary from individual to individual. I mean, that's one of the truest things about older people, or about the aging, even across the lifespan, is that we move in the direction of greater heterogeneity, more individual differences. So we're less alike one another, you know, again, as a whole, the older we get. So age-associated memory changes, though, can be measured. And so here are the ways in which most people's brains change. And it starts happening like around 35. Our capacity to memorize things becomes less efficient. We slow down, no question about it. Simple example. If you used to like to memorize and recite poetry, and you could effortlessly learn a poem in 30 minutes, it might now take you more trials and a couple of hours, but you can still do it. So memory still works as a functioning tool, or, you know, as a cognitive function, unless you have a disorder. But for most older people, what happens is they get frustrated and give up, or say, I guess I don't care that much about memorizing things. And now with how ubiquitous cell phones are and smartphones, most people have turned over memory function to a digital device. So we are no longer actually even exercising the memory part of our brain. So I think that some of those age-associated changes, which is harder to remember, requires multiple trials, still works. You can teach an old dog new tricks, but it'll take a lot longer. And the old dog will have to be patient, and so will the trainer. But people can learn, okay? So that's one thing that slows down. It is also, and anybody who has tried to learn something new, particularly around digital technology, has probably had the experience of, you know, trying to figure out something on an app and having a much younger person take it out of your hands and say, I can do that. You know, I can do that. And well, they can. And they can do it faster. But so what? Give me my phone back. You know, if you give me a fish, I eat for a day, right? And if you teach me to fish, I'll have it for a lifetime. So it's, and I say this all the time. I give a lot of talks on the aging brain, and I, you know, implore people in the audience, because it's all older adults like myself, to not give into this cultural vibe that speed is the most important thing about your brain. Our brains just start going to a different rhythm. We're not as quick, again, in general, but we can get the job done. So that's another age-associated change. Reaction time decreases, our retrieval capacity. Oh, I can't think of that word, or I can't think of that name, and most of us give up. The other thing that happens is that when people can't recall a name or a word or whatever it is, they get anxious. And any of us who have ever been anxious know that it interferes with brain function. You know, anxiety, like a little anxiety, makes you sharp, makes you pay attention, vigilant. You know, your brain is active. It's on alert. But for every threshold, it's different. But too much anxiety makes it less likely that you will recall that word you want or that name that you want. So, you know, I also just tell people to do really simple things like breathe and let the name come to you. Oftentimes, if you're in company and that's happening, somebody will supply the word, the name, the whatever it is. It's not that that's wrong, but it can have people feel a little uneasy. So how do you know when something's really wrong? Like when is your forgetting a name a sign of something, and somebody else is forgetting a name, just age-associated change? And what I say is there's no fast rule on this. Everybody forgets something going into a room, right? We forget our keys, we forget where we put them. But at the point at which you begin to forget more and more things, and it is starting to interfere with how you live your life or how you function, then it's worth sorting out. Because honestly, for many people, that worsening, say, of word finding problems or forgetting a name or misplacing things or getting lost in an unfamiliar city, all of these things that happen for people, accelerate their worry, make it worse, and even if they think, oh my gosh, I'm so much worse than all my friends, it doesn't mean they have dementia. So I'm really big on having people who begin to feel more worried, that they actually speak to their primary care physician about it, because there are medications that interfere with cognition, with our ability to think and remember. Well, I'm watching the clock here because I want to make sure I mention sleep, hearing, and
absolutely
nature.
Go for it. Yes. And I wanted to definitely talk about medication, and that's why you just brought it up. And if you have just tuned in, by the way, you're listening to Healthy Options on WERU Community Radio. I'm Rhonda Feynman. Our guest today is Dr. Susan Weary, and we're speaking about aging well and being resilient.
Many older people have a high number of chronic conditions, but you can live well, right, with chronic conditions. Most people who have a chronic condition are probably on medication. And all medications have both benefits and side effects. And one of the great challenges for physicians and for nurse practitioners, physician assistants, all the health practitioners who prescribe, is trying to find that right balance in a polypharmacy world, meaning that you take a lot of medication. And we know that once people get above five or more medications, the risk of having an adverse event like cognitive decline, greater risk of falling, goes up exponentially. So we really have to take this medication thing seriously, and not only use medications when they're needed, but to use them at the right dose for the shortest period of time, particularly for older people. So when individuals find that they're really worried, they really are having more of the thing that worries them, like more word finding problem, or more frequently getting lost, or being unsure about their driving, having near misses. These are definite red flags that you want to talk to somebody, but it doesn't mean you have dementia. It means that the cause of that worsening needs to be uncovered. And I always start with medications, because not only can medications have side effects that, kind of interact or increase one another, there are some medications that are just not as good for the older brain and have decreased cognition, side effects, right? The other big thing that we talk a lot about in this field is sleep. And it is critically important that people attend to their sleep hygiene, meaning that if you're not a good sleeper, you really do want to pay attention to why, and to try to work towards, with good sleep habits, getting 7 to 9 hours a day. It looks like 7 hours is the least that we should be doing, okay? Because sleep has this great capacity to be restorative. It's really good for our immune system, and it clears out that cortisol. So sleep is really important. Sleep apnea, chronic or obstructive sleep apnea, is probably an under-recognized problem of poor sleep, and so that's worth checking out if poor sleep is an indication. The other thing is, about sleep, is that there's a lot of debate about naps. Okay,
that was my next question. Thank you.
Yeah. I am in the naps are good for you camp, because naps add up to that 7 hours a day. What isn't good about that, but you got to be strategic in your nap timing and not sleep too long. Okay. So what we know about good sleep is getting as much natural daylight as you can early in the day, exercising early in the day. You want to, like, that peak performance kind of time. If you want to take a nap after lunch, a lot of people do to improve their cognitive function. A lot of CEOs, a lot of high functioning people will do a 20 minute power nap. I'm personally a big fan. Now, would I say sleep for 2 hours in the afternoon? It might make it harder for you to get to sleep at night and stay asleep through the night, because we actually want to build a little bit of a sleep deficit so that you do fall asleep at night. And there are people who are more expert in sleep than I am, and you might want to have one of them on. But I'm increasingly paying attention to sleep, sleep habits, promoting good sleep, and giving people permission to nap, because naps are totally restorative, and we all have our own natural biorhythm. But what's important, exposure to you know, natural light, if you will, during the day is really important. And then letting things, you know, wind down at night. Everybody, I think, now knows about putting your cell phones away. Not, you know, not a lot of screen time at night, and you know, no TVs in the bedroom, that sort of thing. But there's a lot of good sleep hygiene tips out there. So sleep is really restorative. That's my bottom line message.
Great.
And sleep includes naps. So I'm not worried about people getting up in the middle of the night because they had a nice nap. Just probably don't let it go past an hour.
Well,
it's probably
20 minutes. Power nap.
Power nap is ideal. 40 minutes, pseudo power, I guess, or less power. But that's my thought about that.
And obviously, a dark bedroom is always good. Keep the light. Yeah. Part of the sleep hygiene.
Yes, exactly, Rhonda. And, you know, kind of cooler temperatures as well is another helpful strategy, I think, that people often promote. And having a little ritual at bedtime, right? And no caffeine drinks. All of those things are really good.
Yes. What about hearing and vision? You were.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. We know, again, and at a public health level, population health level, that addressing decline in hearing, which, again, happens sort of in the 50s, is critically important for, here we go again, reducing the risk, right, of developing dementia due to any cause, but also promoting better social connection, because people who develop hearing loss begin to withdraw. They get tired of saying, "What did you say?" They get tired of people hearing or asking, "I just said," or saying, "I just said that," right? So hearing loss has definite implications for our social connection, level of engagement, cognitive stimulation, desire and willingness to learn new things. So although the data, quite frankly, doesn't support addressing hearing loss way late in life as reducing risk of anything, there is a lot of good data that says it promotes health. So I think I heard a primary care doc recently give the advice, though, that, you know, what may or may not be more important than getting a hearing test and getting a hearing aid, maybe, particularly if you're partnered and you live with a spouse who's always saying to you, get your hearing check. Another simple thing that spouses can do before they get that hearing test is to make sure that they maintain eye contact when they're speaking, and to make sure that they're not yelling from the other room. It looks like one of those natural things of aging, hearing decline and aging, is that we do lose some ability to discriminate voices from within other background noise. And so it makes it a little harder to hear when there's running water or a TV on. So it's a really good, you know, it's a kind thing to do. Get in the habit of looking at people when you speak to them, not having other distractions and having a conversation. And so I thought that was
that's very important. I think another cartoon is something about most of marriage is people talking at each other from different rooms, and all you hear is what?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I love the eye contact, because that does many, many things. It's not only can you hear me, but it's also I'm with you. I'm connected.
Yes.
Yeah.
I want to make sure I put in a plug for the natural world before we pivot away.
Please
from that.
Please do.
Because I know we're coming to the end.
Oh, goodness.
And there's a lot, there's like a growing community of forest bathers in Maine.
Yes.
I think you and I had mentioned this before, which is really interesting. For people who aren't familiar with it, I encourage you to read about it. Some people credit Korea, some people credit Japan, but wherever it came from, it has a cooler name in Japan, which is Shinrin-yoku. And forest bathing does not mean taking off your clothes and showering in the woods. What it does mean, however,
which is a great thing to do, I'm
sure.
It's
also really joyful, right? I'm not saying, but forest bathing refers to having an embodied time in nature, right? So it's a mindful, intentional engagement of all the senses in the natural world. And it is so potent. The reason I wanted to make sure I got to it,
yes,
it is one of the most potent ways to rid ourselves of some of that cortisol. The studies are really interesting, and this has been around for a while. And I think that Florence Williams with the Nature Fix was on your program before.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And she gets a lot of credit for popularizing this notion of really, even whether you're in an urban environment or a beautiful state like Maine, being out in the natural world. And again, we now have some data, 20 minutes. So I recently wrote a little article called The Nature Pill, because I got tired of fighting everybody. People want pills, right? I don't like to prescribe pills, but now I'm prescribing the nature pill.
That's
20
good.
Minutes, 20 minutes a day, one time a day, three times a week. Be in the natural world. What's the natural world? Is any place where there are living organisms with some high degree of complexity that allow you to engage what some researcher has called soft fascination. And I love that term because it is a way of being present, but without engaging this really fixed attention. And it turns out that it triggers this default network in our brain that, you know, some people would call simply daydreaming. There is something about being in the natural world that activates that daydreaming part of the brain, which is really good for creativity. Because I'm on my cortisol kick, it's really good for lowering cortisol. I'm on that kick because of the world. You know, these are hard times we live in. But anyway, to be in the natural world, the pill is once a day, 20 minutes, three times a week will lower your cortisol. You get unlimited refills. And if you do it every day, you will have not only lower cortisol, but you will have more joy. And
Yeah, I love it. And it doesn't mean that you're hiking Mount Katahdin, you know, although that's a great thing to do. But if you're, but you have to prepare for that. But you're walking, you're at a good pace, or even just strolling. What about plants in your home? You know,
plants in your home really help. Gardening helps. And for people who can't get outside for whatever reason, even looking out the window at trees, animals, the changing of the season also helps. And I'm so glad you mentioned that, because I think a lot of people think when you say, oh, you got to be out in nature and taking hikes, you know, forest bathing is a thing, right? And there is a certain way that you do it. And it does take more time. But being in nature can be sitting in your garden. It can be watching. It's really the important thing about the nature pill is doing it in an embodied way. So smelling the earth, smelling the air, feeling it on your body, looking at the changes in the leaves around you, right? And so listening for the sounds, whether it's birdsong or anything else.
So just be in, we are nature. So be with yourself in nature. We are at the end of this program. We just have to have you come back and talk about forest bathing some more. Our guest today on Healthy Options has been geriatric psychiatrist, Dr. Susan Weary. Thank you, Dr. Weary, for speaking with us today. This will be posted, and all of the websites and some of the things we've talked about will be available on the public affairs section. Thanks to Joel Mann, WERU, for engineering support, our co-producer, Petra Hall. And as always, thanks to all of our WERU listeners and supporters. This is Rhonda Feynman wishing you the best in health.